walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzz and the leaves beneath my feet. Ramble up the stairwell to the hall of books. Since we got the interweb, these hardly get used.
Hello, Kodiak. Welcome to another episode of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. My name is Athenia. I'm chair of the Kodiak Public Library Association and host of your show today. And what a good show it is! We have a local author with us today. Stacy Studebaker dropped by KODK, and Tayton got a chance to talk to her about her life in Kodiak and her new book that she's releasing, which is Octopus in the Outhouse. The Kodiak Public Library Association is actually hosting Stacy Studebaker. She's doing a book reading on January 23rd, but I think she's coming a little sooner to the Aleutic Museum. Tayton will tell you more about that in a second. And then after the interview and a few songs by Stacy Studebaker's band Waterborne, we've got our lively live chats. And I did a short interview with Celia, who was at the Kodiak Public Library last week with a Battle of the Books Comes Alive event. So I'm talking with her. I'm also going to fill you in on some more events happening this month and over the holidays at the Kodiak Public Library. And then, of course, we've still got some great book reviews from Kodiak people who want to share with you what they're reading. So stay tuned for the rest of the hour. Now, let's get to Tayton and his Beyond the Cover segment with Stacy Studebaker here on Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA on KODK 90.7.
So I'll watch you through the bookcase, imagining
this is Tayton, and welcome to Beyond the Cover, our segment in Dog-Eared Reads, where we'll talk with authors, musicians, and other performers coming to or living in Kodiak. On today's segment of Beyond the Cover, we'll chat with local Kodiak author and naturalist Stacy Studebaker. Studebaker has a master's in science teaching and environmental education, and worked as a science teacher with the Kodiak Island Borough School District for 20 years. She's also worked as a ranger, botanist, musician, artist, and photographer, and was a founding member of the Kodiak Audubon Society. For a number of years, she hosted and co-produced My Green Earth, an award-winning weekly radio show on the environment that aired throughout Alaska, nationally and internationally. She led the Kodiak Gray Whale Project from 2000 to 2010 to treat the bones of a whale and reconstruct its skeleton for display at the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge Center. Studebaker was awarded the Celia Hunter Award in 2011 by the Alaska Conservation Foundation for her lifetime of volunteer conservation work. And in the last 5 years, she self-published 3 books under her own Sense of Place Press, the first being Wildflowers and Other Plant Life of the Kodiak Archipelago. In 2013, she published Hey Bear, Ho Bear, a children's book that teaches about bear awareness. And just this past month, she published Octopus in the Outhouse. Stacy Studebaker, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Stacy, after reading your long list of achievements, including a ton of environmental service, I have to ask, what haven't you done in Kodiak?
A lot of things. Many, many things. I tend to focus pretty much on conservation and environmental issues, as people know, and also with my photography and my artwork, focusing on expressing the beauty of the world around me.
Yeah, you're certainly involved with a ton of stuff here in Kodiak. What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you always know that you wanted to be involved in the environment and education, or did you start somewhere else?
No, I didn't know that early on. I thought I was going to be a veterinarian because I was very horsey as a child and through high school and into college. Then I started getting into hiking and camping more, although I did quite a bit with my family when I was young, but it didn't occur to me that you could actually apply that and use that for something other than just pure enjoyment and recreation.
What eventually then brought you to Kodiak?
Well, right out of college, I started working in Yosemite National Park as an outdoor ed instructor at a wonderful outdoor ed school called the Yosemite Institute. And I was an educator, so every day I picked up my little group of kids, from whatever school was visiting us at the time, and off we went into the woods and up the trails to the waterfalls. And I just got so inspired about introducing children to the outdoors and just seeing city kids light up, you know. I mean, we had groups of kids that come up from inner city Watts and places like that in Southern California who had never seen a squirrel, never seen a river, never dipped their cup into a stream to drink pure mountain glacial water. And it just clicked that I knew I wanted to be an educator of some kind. And so after my biology degree, I went back to school and got a master's in science teaching and environmental ed.
And then from there came to Kodiak, or did you leave Kodiak for that and then come back?
Well, no, I worked in, after Yosemite, I made my way up to Glacier Bay National Park after reading lots of John Muir in Yosemite and found out that he did a trip to Alaska. And after reading his book, I went to Glacier Bay and ended up working for the Park Service for several summers there. And then from there, worked in Katmai National Park for a few summers. And in between summers, working on my master's degree back east at a college in New Hampshire. But once I was finished with my degree, it was on to Alaska for sure. And so I applied for teaching jobs in biology, which was my expertise, and got a job in Kodiak. And I thought at the time, oh, I'll spend some time in Kodiak and then I'll move on to some other part of Alaska. And well, you know, the rest of the story, I never left.
Talked to a number of people in Kodiak who've had similar stories.
Well, Kodiak just had everything that I wanted. I had worked in these national parks as a ranger naturalist for many, many years, and I always felt kind of cloistered, you know, you're surrounded by other people of like mind, you know, and that's great when you're young to have all these great environmentalists around you all the time, but I kind of wanted to launch into the real world and still be surrounded by beauty every day and access to beauty, and so Kodiak just had it all.
So you ended up teaching the high school for about 20 years before retiring from there, and then were involved in a ton of just environmental projects. And then your first book was Wildflowers and Other Plant Life of the Kodiak Archipelago. It was a guidebook. And then much of the other literature you've worked on, such as the Kodiak Audubon's Hiking and Birding Guide, has been in kind of the same vein. But then recently you switched to writing children's books. Hey Bear, Ho Bear was published in 2013, and then Octopus and the Outhouse that just came out. So why the switch? Why write children's book?
Well, for many years, starting in the 80s, I'm musical, and I was in a couple of bands and then formed a new band called Waterbound, and we ended up writing our own material and recording three CDs, music CDs, and I wrote some of the songs for that. And two of the songs I decided to turn into children's books because over the years, people said, you know, those lyrics of those songs are pretty catchy. You know, you might want to think about writing them down in a children's book. And so I did. You know, I actually started out the first one with Hey Bear, Ho Bear, and it's been very successful. It's just in almost 3 years, it's already in its fourth printing. So it's been very popular. I have it, and all my books are in stores now from Fairbanks, Gulliver's Books, way up there in Fairbanks by the college campus, and all the way down to Ketchikan at Parnassus Books, a wonderful independent bookstore down in Ketchikan.
Well, that's wonderful. So it's spread out all across.
All over the state. Yeah,
And then especially thinking of it, it's definitely based on Kodiak and the Kodiak Bear, the imagery that's in it.
Right. We tried not to make it too Kodiak specific because I wanted it to be able to apply to other parts of Alaska that where people need to be bear aware. The lessons in the book about human behavior in bear country are pretty universal, and that's what we wanted. But because my illustrator and I are both from Kodiak, naturally, the scenery is definitely Kodiak.
So you're going to be doing a reading on January 23rd at the library, and then a little bit before that, coming up on December 12th, you'll be reading Octopus in the Outhouse at the Aleutic Museum. I hear you dress up as one of the characters. Can you tell us a little bit about your new book, the age group or groups it's most appropriate for, and what visitors can expect at those upcoming readings?
Well, the main character is a little girl. Named Lila Liverwort. And she has a little sidekick, a little pal named Herman the Ermine. And he's not really a pet, but he just kind of follows her around. I just love Ermine. We have them under our cabin out at Passagjack, and I see them all over the place. And they're one of the most fascinating and interesting little critters around. And so I wanted to integrate a little non-human friend as one of the characters that's in both of these books. For Octopus in the Outhouse, I write my books in a 7-meter rhyming format. So they're fun to read. They're really fun to read out. And they were based on songs, of course. I was very influenced by Robert Service. You know, there's strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. And that kind of rhythmic poetry I've always just loved. And so I kind of gravitated that way, you know, for my own writing. And I get good feedback from people who say that they really enjoy reading these out loud to children. And if it's fun for the parents to read, then you're more apt to get the kids interested. If the parents get bored with reading the books, they might not want to read them very often. And so I think the rhyming part of the format helps everybody to get into it.
So you retired from teaching high school classes, and then, you know, like we just talked about, Hey Bear, Ho Bear certainly teaches kids about bear awareness. Has your teaching influenced your writing in any way, or are those kind of two separate endeavors for you?
Well, I'm a biologist at heart. I mean, I am just a geek biologist, and particularly a botanist. After I retired, I spent 10 summers in the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge documenting the plant life for the refuge, because there wasn't any plant list or any resource to go to really learn about the flora and the unique flora we have here. And so that's what kind of spurred me on to write this book. I was doing all this research, and people said, well, you should put this into a book so we can identify the plants too. I mean, you're a botanist, you know their names, and you know what the background of each plant is, but share it. So I wrote the field guide, and that was the first endeavor to write. That was great fun, you know, to be able to do that.
So I have a little surprise here. I was able to track down one of your band CDs. Waterbound, right, was the name of
name of the band,
group.
Right.
And how what years did you guys play, or how long?
Oh boy, let's see. I think we started in the late 80s, you know, I'm thinking like 87 through about 97, about 10 years
spread out.
And we recorded the 3 music CDs during that time.
Right, right. And this is an Alaska Maritime retrospective in 2009 when it came out.
That was the last one we did, yeah.
I'm going to play part of one song here for us, and then we'll come back in a moment if that's
okay.
That's
fine.
Cool. You're listening to Beyond the Cover and Dog-Eared Reads, and we're talking with local Kodiak author and naturalist, Stacy Studebaker.
Oh, my kayak and me, we paddle the sea. Like the whales and sea otters, we prefer the blue waters and the feeling so free. We're long and we're narrow, and go straight as an arrow. Just gliding along, singing this song, my kayak and me. You don't need wheels or a saddle, just 2 arms and a paddle. With a comfortable seat, you can rest your poor feet, there'll be no crowds to battle. Bring your camera and binos, there might be seals but no rhinos. Know your currents and tides, or go along with a guide and hope that he knows. And if you think we look odd, I'm like a pea in a pod. With my spray skirt on right, we're complete water kite in the rain and the fog. And if over I go, I do an Eskimo roll. And once again I'm upright with a horizon in sight and ready to go. Oh, my kayak and me, oh, my kayak and me, we paddle the sea, yeah, we paddle the sea. Like the whales and sea otter, we prefer the blue waters and the feeling so free. We're long and we're narrow, and go straight as an arrow. Just gliding along, singing this song, my kayak and me. Yodel-ay, yodel-ay, hoo, yodel-ay, 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 yodel-ay. And if you want to go solo, try a kayak with one pole. But if you like company,
get two holes or three, either way it's so mellow.
So it sounds like there might be a book in there, right? You have the kayak and put it on the spray skirt.
Oh, I don't know, but that other wonderful voice singing harmony is Jane Eisman, who is my good friend and musician friend who recorded that with me, and she just sings the most beautiful harmonies.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about the band. Who else is in it, and then what did you do for this song?
It started out with myself and Brad Stevens and Ron Monroe and D. Todd Littlefield. It was a whole different group. And those three guys ended up leaving and leaving Kodiak. So the other following recording, Alaska Animal Tales and Tunes, which was recorded after this one, was basically just Jane Eisman and myself and a little bit of Ron Monroe in there.
And you know, you wrote this song, right?
The kayak song, right.
I heard, Stacy, that the idea for your book, and you mentioned this actually a little bit earlier in the interview, Hey Bear, Ho Bear was inspired by one of your group's songs.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and how your experience with music, whether singing or writing songs, either way, has played a role in your creative writing?
Yeah, well, like I say, I've always liked rhymes. And when I was a park ranger, I used to have to memorize Robert Service to do campfire talks. Before rangers in national parks had all this equipment now to do all these beautiful programs with screens, we had to sit around campfires and entertain people in the campgrounds. And Robert Service was kind of a natural thing to do. I just love writing, you know, I really do. And I like integrating educational concepts into the writing and making it fun and educational. So Hey Bear, Ho Bear is a... It's not just a goofy book about bears. If you read it, you know, it actually has some lessons to it, not only on bear behavior and bear biology, but also on how humans should behave to be able to coexist with bears. It's a lesson in coexistence.
So kind of switching gears here a little bit, earlier we talked about some of the imagery in the book. The illustrator for both of your children's books, Kay Underwood, has some beautiful imagery to go along with the stories and certainly captures Kodiak and Alaska and in your new book, all over Alaska and outhouses. How did you two first connect, you and Kay?
Well, I've known Kay probably since the early 80s. She's been back and forth from Kodiak to other places since the 70s. And I met her very early on, another fellow artist. She is just a brilliant artist, those people that have watched her art develop over the years. She fishes in the summertime at a set net site down near Alitak with her family, and she's raised four kids. And most of them are in college. She still has one in high school. In the wintertime, she and her husband and son live in Anchorage. So he participates in all kinds of sports and things up there. But her heart really is here on the island. And because she also is a biologist, she has a keen sense for the detail to get the biology correct in our books. And that's what we decided we really wanted to do, is make our books of some natural history value. And we sure get a lot of good feedback about that. Biology-oriented, nature-oriented parents seem to really appreciate that we make an emphasis to do that. And also, because she just goes all out with details on every single spread of every page, she's got the butterfly, she's got the little bitty bird, she's got the details, all these plants and whatnot, we decided we wanted to really draw attention to that. So in the back and the inside of the back cover on each of our books, there's a naturalist checklist that lists all the plants and animals that are represented. And in both, it's well over 60 different plants and animals. After you read the book with the child, you can go through and look for the different plants and animals and check them off just like you would if you went to a national park and you got a checklist, you know, and you went around and identified the plants and the rocks and whatnot, and the birds, of course. And so we wanted to extend that. And we've never seen that done before. We just kind of came up with that idea because we really wanted to emphasize the fact that we have so much biological detail in our books.
Right. Well, it seems like a natural fit. It's a book that has Alaska and Hey Bear, Ho Bear, Kodiak is the background. So it seems like, yeah, it could be a natural fit.
Yeah, yeah.
So can you tell us a little bit more about your writing process and your work with illustrator Kay Underwood? Do you write the book and then give it to her to illustrate? Do you write it together, write it and illustrate it as you go?
I write the text. And then I do all the layout myself. Before I started making books, I had to go back to school and learn some computer programs, particularly Adobe InDesign. And I do all my layout in that program. And so I had the format already set up, and I have the text placed on the pages. And then I hand that over to Kay, and then we go through it page by page and decide what we want to have, how we want to illustrate the concepts of the text. And she does them first with just pencil sketches, you know, just little sketches. We block everything out, we go through it, and then we go through it again, get everything just in the right place and decide on all the right plants and animals for the scene. And then once we got that blocked out, then she goes through it again with color. Her medium is color pencil. She does these beautiful illustrations in color pencil. And then once she's got all those done, she takes them to a company in Anchorage and has them digitally scanned, so high resolution digital scans. And then she sends those to me, and then I pop them into the format and lay the text over the top and design all the back covers and front covers and all that part of it. Once that's done, then we send our files off to a broker in Anchorage called Alaska Print Brokers, who found me my wonderful printer in China, Everbest Printing Company. And that's where the books are printed. And so off they go. Off the files go to China, and then they come back. It takes about 3 months turnaround to get the books back once they're sent off, because they have to get printed, and then they have to come across the Pacific on a container ship, and they have to go through customs in Seattle, and then transferred to another container ship and then up here. So it's a long process.
That is a long process.
It's a long time to wait.
I think a lot of us would be surprised at what all goes into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so you've self-published all three of your books under Sense of Place Press, the name of your publishing company. So did you start out pitching the books to other publishing companies or agents, or did you just start out saying, hey, I want to do this myself?
Well, I wrote the field guide first, and it's such an area-specific book, and there just aren't a lot of people in this region, and it's hard to find a publisher who will publish a book that isn't going to be selling thousands and thousands, because that's how they make money, you know. Once I realized that, the likelihood of finding a publisher, then I started investigating the world of self-publishing. And I am so glad that I went that direction. I have had nothing but positive experiences with it. It's been great.
I'm guessing you might get quite a few questions about that then for maybe aspiring writers around town. Would you have any advice for somebody who is an aspiring writer, whether they're young or old or anywhere in between?
Well, it's not for everybody, and it works well for the kind of books that I do, which are heavily illustrated books. And I took all the pictures in my field guide, for instance, so I illustrated that. So for the kinds of books that I write, I don't write serious novels that are all text, page by page, you know, and it's pretty, that's a little more straightforward process to find a publisher or to self-publish with that kind of book. But it's not for everybody. And if you're going to self-publish, and if you're going to self-distribute, and you're going to manage your own company, you got to be ready to work hard. It's not easy. And you have to have somewhat of an outgoing personality to make cold calls to various bookstores and make contact with booksellers. And you can't get too discouraged if they turn you down. You just got to keep doing it. It takes a lot of work. It's a part-time, three-quarter-time job for me now.
So you've done all the marketing yourself?
All the marketing, yeah. All the distribution. I have all three books now on Amazon, so people can find them who aren't here in the state, because all the books are sold just within the state in various stores, not outside the state. So it's just an evolving process. I'm learning new things all the time. But I encourage people that if they have an idea, to just do it. Do the research. Go to the college. Talk to people there. There are writers at the college who also have published books. And talk to other people and just get information about it, and then make up your own mind. If you have a universal story or novel that would sell well all over the nation, then that's a whole nother thing. You know, I really can't advise anybody on that. But you never know. You know, you might write a blockbuster and end up selling a million copies.
So we only have time for a couple more questions, Stacy. Would you have any advice then for just the writing process? Maybe some tips and tricks that you have, or just something you might say to someone who has that aspiration?
Well, I'm a very science-y writer. Most of the writing that I have done is science-oriented. I just got an article published in an international magazine called Orchids Magazine from the American Orchid Society on Kodiak orchids, for instance, a very technical article, botanical article. And that's the kind of writing I'm most comfortable with. It's got strict rules, you know, and I love jumping out of that into the realm of writing children's books, because it's just fun. It's just really, really fun. And I would say, you know, there are days when I sit down to try to write more verses or more parts to my book, and I just can't write. I'm just writer blocked sometimes for weeks, and I just know that I'll get over it. And I go for long walks, and usually if I'm stumbling over a certain stretch of words, for instance, I just put down the computer and go for a walk, and oftentimes the most creative ideas come to me while I'm in motion.
Well, that kind of leads us to the last question. What's next for Stacey Studebaker?
Well, Kay and I have been getting such good response to our books together, and we absolutely love working together. It's a synergistic relationship. And if you've ever had a friend and had a synergistic creative endeavor with another individual, it just can't beat it. It is so much fun. And we are thinking about another book, another children's book, but I'm not going to give away too much.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Stacey Studebaker, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you very much. This has been delightful.
Stacey Studebaker will be reading Octopus in the Outhouse in the Aleutic Museum's gallery on Saturday, December 12th from 12:30 to 1:30 p.m. The Aleutic Museum is located at 215 Mission Road here in Kodiak. She'll also be doing a reading on January 23rd from noon to 3 at the Kodiak Public Library. This is Tayton. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Cover and Dog-Eared Reads. Until next time, happy reading.
Thanks, Tayton and Stacy. That was fantastic. Let's hear another song by Waterbound, Stacy Studebaker's band. Here we have Tidal Wave on Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA.
Your love comes over me like a tidal wave rushing to the shore on a shining sea. I feel my heart skip a beat and the earthquake under my feet. When your love washes over me, I heard the warning. It was so loud and clear. It said a tidal wave was coming, so don't stay near. It said to seek higher ground, someplace that's high and dry, somewhere that I could sit and watch that wave roll by. But I did not heed the warning, because I did not believe your love could make such a difference in my hour of need. And so I did not run, oh no, I did not leave. And when that big tsunami came, it swept me right off my feet. Your love comes over me like a tidal wave rushing to the shore on a shining sea. I feel my heart skip a beat and the earthquake under my feet when your love washes over me. I should have heeded the warning to evacuate, but when I saw that tsunami, it was much too late. It rose up higher and higher right before my eyes, and then came crashing down around me, much to my surprise. Well, I had no idea that I would feel this way, but now I'm positively seismic to think about that day. Your love comes over me like a tidal wave rushing to the shore on a shining sea. I feel my heart skip a beat and the earthquake under my feet when your love washes over me.
Welcome back to Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. I'm Athenia, host of this show. I want to take a minute to celebrate the fact that this week is the second anniversary of the grand opening of the new Kodiak Public Library. The building is beautiful. There are a lot of resources that you can use down at the library, and there's lots of fun activities happening. We want you to check it out. There's always a calendar of events up at the circulation desk if you're interested in seeing what's happening. But for now, let me give you a quick run. Down. Tomorrow, Wednesday, the Kitchen Gardener series at 6 p.m. is doing a little workshop on garden journaling. Later this week, on the 11th, All Is Calm is the movie that's going to be playing at 6:30 to 8:30 in the evening. Next Monday, the 14th, Serial Readers, that's a fun little group that starts at 7 o'clock where they discuss articles from newspapers or magazines that have sparked our interest. Friday the 18th, just in time for the annual Audubon Christmas Bird Count, is The Real Stories Film Night featuring Birders, The Central Park Effect at 6:30 p.m. On Saturday, for the children, there's a free workshop for Fractured Fairy Tales. That's for ages 10 to 16, happening from 1 to 4 p.m. And Sunday the 20th, the Golden Tones are going to be performing for the Sunday Sounds from 2 to 3 p.m. A lot of fun activities happening at the Kodiak Public Library, and that's not even talking about Christmas. On the 22nd, from 2 to 4, there's Seasonal Cards and Decorations Workshop. On the 23rd, from 1 to 2, there's Holiday Stories for Kids from Around the World. And on the 24th at 2:30, we're going to be watching A Christmas Story, the holiday classic. And then the library closes at 5, and it's closed again on Christmas Day and New Year's Day too, of course. So come down and check out the beautiful building. 2 years open, and if you haven't seen it by now, it's time to get in there. Now I want to share with you a little interview I did last week when I went to the Kodiak Public Library and talked with Celia Whitehead about the Battle of the Books Comes Alive programming that the Kodiak Public Library put on for us. She explains a little bit about what Battle of the Books is and tells us about some of the top Battle of the Books picks from our Kodiak kids. Let's hear.
So my name is Celia Whitehead, and I am working with the library to offer some really cool interactive after-school programming for kids that are involved with Battle of the Books. And if you don't know, if you don't have a kid between, I think, like first grade and up through high school who might be doing this, Battle of the Books is a program that actually started in Alaska many, many years ago, but now is done throughout the country, where they have a committee who chooses really top quality books for each age group. There's like a third, fourth grade group, and fifth, sixth, kind of like that. Books across many different subjects and genres. Schools can register to have teams for Battle of the Books, and then the teams get coaches, and the kids are encouraged to read every single book on the list, with the goal that in February they have a giant tournament where they have trivia questions asked. As a team, they have to answer these trivia questions, which are really quite involved about the books. They ask things like, in which book does a character feel teary instead of screechy? So you really have to remember what language was used in the book. And they encourage you to learn all of the book's titles and authors. So the teams are doing a lot of detail-oriented, like practice questions kind of things. But here at the library, we call this Battle of the Books Comes Alive. We're taking it off the page, getting kids to embody characters, to talk about what the characters are feeling, what they're doing, sequence of events, what's happened to them up to this point. And we've been doing some filming, which hopefully we'll be able to show at the First Friday Art Night. In this after-school series that just happened this week, the first 3 days of December, we've had groups of students who are giving book talks, which is when a student embodies a character from the book for a moment, acts out a little scene, and then tries to get people interested in reading the book. For example, I think I've got one written up here, a little script that one of the students worked on about The House of the Scorpion by Nancy Farmer. Imagine a world where you have no family, because you are a clone, the clone of a powerful opium lord named El Patron. Wondering why you were created, you soon find out that you are only for the use of giving your heart up. A journey will take you to... And it goes on like that. So you can hear that there's really great use of vocabulary, getting people interested. We've also done activities where we create vignettes, a new vocabulary word for lots of the kids. And in groups, the kids choose a scene from one of their favorite books and then freeze. They each choose a character in the scene, and the characters all freeze. And one by one, they come to life, and they talk about, as that character, what's happening for them in that scene, and how are they feeling, and what's gone on to get them to this point. So really getting involved in the storylines, acting out the storylines, using some of the vocabulary, and exploring those inner lives of characters, which I think really helps people get more involved in what's going on in a book and be able to remember what happens in a book a lot better. So hopefully in the end it will be really good for the Battle of the Books tournament, but for now it's just really fun time with a great group of kids. The library is doing some more programming for Battle of the Book. We haven't done anything for the kind of first through third grade group yet, and I think that there's going to be a Battle of the Books scrimmage coming up, focusing on getting students from different schools to work together and mix up the teams and work with new students as they prepare for the tournament. So if you're looking for a great book for your reader, kind of between the third and eighth grade levels here, although I think they're pretty much across the board. I've got the favorites that have come out from this week of activities. From the third, fourth grade level of Battle of the Books comes El Defo by C.C. Bell. This is a nonfiction story, but it's written in cartoons. And it's about a girl and her true story of when she fell sick with meningitis when she was little and lost her hearing. So it's about navigating the world without being able to hear. And the main character draws herself in this cartoon as a bunny rabbit. So this was definitely pick number one across the board for the third, fourth grade level. In the fifth, sixth grade level, once again, across the board, top pick number one is called Who is Stan Lee? By Jeff Edgers. If you don't know who Stan Lee is, you can find out when you read this book. I didn't know, but now I know that Stan Lee was the creator of many Marvel superheroes, which I think is a big draw in this book that has a lot of really nice pencil sketches, as well as another nonfiction story about a real person who created Spider-Man and Iron Man and Wonder Woman and a lot like characters like that. For the middle school level, 7th and 8th grade, the top pick was Endangered by Elliot Schrieffer. And Endangered is a fictional story, but based on very true events set in, let me just double check, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The story of a girl who splits her time between the USA and the Democratic Republic of Congo, where her mom works in a bonobo research and rescue facility. And it's action-packed, was the description that my students gave it. I just started reading it, so I haven't gotten all the way through, but I'm already definitely pulled in by the story of empathy between humans and animals and that connection with our very near cousins and what happens when a country is torn by war and how difficult that can be for a kid. So, three great reads recommended by the Battle of the Books participants in Kodiak.
Perfect. Thanks, Celia.
Yeah.
Thanks, Celia. That was a lovely segue into our Community Roar book reviews. And remember, if you have read a book and you want to share it on our show, Dog-Eared Reads by the KPLA, we want to hear from you. You can always call me, Athenia, at 907-539-7660, and we'll talk about meeting up at the radio station. Or if you want to do it at home, on your own computer, or come into the library and do it on one of the iPads or computers there, you can create it in any app, save it, and email it to me at kpla.alaska@gmail.com, and then we'll get it on the air for you. Nia and Katie are up next with a book review, and they're actually reviewing my favorite book and movie of all time, The Princess Bride by William Goldman. Let's see what they have to say about it.
Hey there, and welcome to another book talk with Katie and Nia. Today we are doing The Princess Bride by William Goldman.
Okay, Nia, this is my favorite book of all time. I know I say that about every book I read, but this one really is my favorite.
So this is a really interesting book because not only does it have a great plot and a great story and fabulous characters.
Fabulous characters. Their backstories are beautiful. Go on.
Thank you, Katie. The book is told from the perspective of a guy who read this book when he was younger and is now rereading it again.
So it's a book within a book.
Every so often, he'll interject and say what he thinks about a character or a situation. And it says on the cover, The Princess Bride, S. Morgenstern's classic tale of true love and high adventure. Actually, S. Morgenstern didn't write the book. William Goldman is pretending like he is abridging the novel by S. Morgenstern, but really, it's not. It's his story. He made it up.
I think it's a genius setup, honestly. It had me fooled for like half the book.
Yeah, I figured it out today when Katie told me.
Yeah, okay. I love the elaboration and the backstory and the anecdotes in this novel. Like, the movie is fabulous, but it doesn't capture all these stories from these characters that come together, intertwine to make another story.
All the characters are so beautifully described in this book. You don't love all the characters. Like, some books make you love every single character they have. In this book, I actually hate one of the main characters because...
Who is this, Nia?
Okay, so first we meet Buttercup, who is a vain, spoiled, immature girl.
I resent that!
She gets everything she wants because she is really beautiful, and it's kind of annoying because she's not really really smart at all. And then she gets jealous and decides she is in love with the farm boy named Wesley, who she treated horribly until she realized that she loved him, which I'm slightly skeptical of.
I, on the other hand, think Buttercup is fabulous. I don't think she is perfect, like Wesley.
Wesley, yes. Wesley the farm boy.
Oh, don't change the subject. I'm sorry, I'm getting heated now. I don't think she's perfect, but none of us really are. She was a girl when she was mean to Wesley, and she was just playful. And I think that she is smart. I don't know where I'm going with this. She's a good character. Okay.
Well, now let's move on to Wesley. Wesley, on the other hand, is perfect in every single way.
I know, he's totally unrealistic, which makes me love him even more. I think everyone who reads this book falls in love with Wesley
because not only is he good-looking, charming, intelligent, and great with a sword, his love for Buttercup is so genuine that he doesn't care that she's immature and selfish and vain. What's your rebuttal to that?
I'm just gonna say that was underhanded and angsty, and I thought you were better than that.
But Wesley, he ends up leaving in the very beginning, and you think he's gone forever. But then, later, there's a plot twist, and he returns.
We're not giving away the book!
My second favorite character to Wesley is Inigo Montoya.
Oh my goodness, same!
His father was killed when he was very young, and his life's goal is to murder the man who killed his father. And so he spends his whole life training to become the best swordsman on Earth.
Inigo Montoya squeezes rocks for 7 years just to build up his strength. Dedication, my friends, dedication. He goes to the masters for so many years. How many years did he train?
For like his whole life.
For his entire life to kill the one man who killed his father. He is so inspiring. Honestly, I mean, I probably wouldn't have that much dedication to kill one man. But then again, my mother wasn't killed. My father wasn't killed by a six-figure man.
Inigo's line in the book that has become very famous, like through the movie too, is, "My name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die."
That is a line that just, boom, it impacts you. Even though it's so commonly used nowadays. Out of all the things he could say, he could like yell at him. He could scream at him for killing his father. He could torture him. But he just goes straight to the point because that's really what his life was about. Getting straight to that point.
And not necessarily getting revenge, but just avenging his father. Not taking revenge on the person like, you ruined my life because you killed my father. It's more like, you took my father's life in such a brutal manner. You deserve the same. You have it coming.
Now, my other favorite character, which I'm going to tell you about all of these characters, is Fezzik.
Fezzik, who is like a giant, and he's not that smart, but it's okay because he is literally such a sweetheart.
He's
like
the nicest guy.
He is the epitome of gentle giant.
Honestly. And his backstory in this book, it's just brought me to tears a few times.
He was always teased because he was always bigger than the other kids and stronger, and he didn't really know his strength. And then his father started teaching him self-defense so he wouldn't get picked on, and he ended up becoming like a wrestler or something, right? And so then no one likes him at the wrestling matches because he always wins and people don't like that. And so he ends up leaving and he meets up with Inigo and Vicini.
Vicini
is this kind of manipulative, intelligent, but rather cocky in the fact that he thinks he's more intelligent than everyone else,
which takes away from his intelligence.
He's a Sicilian, and that's kind of how they refer to him in the very beginning when they kidnap Buttercup, and they just refer to him as the Sicilian. So you're kind of like, who is this guy?
Yeah, I watched the movie before I read the book.
I
recommend watching the movie before you read the book because it was casted so perfectly that when you read the book, the characters' iconic voices will be in your head and it'll make it all the more interesting. Okay, this book has something for everyone. It has humor, romance, action, evil, good, revenge, giants, sword fights, battles of wits. Good guys, yes. Bad guys, lies, truths, death, life, and most importantly, true love. I did write that out beforehand. I'm actually quite proud of that.
I like this book because it has adventure, it has romance, it has sword fights, which are always fun.
They are indeed always fun. My favorite aspect of this book is the humor and the wit and charm that just flows. It's not like people trying to be funny. It's just like the characters, they know what they're doing. They know that it's funny. That brings me to another point, Nia. Each character has one or two defining qualities, which makes the book so interesting. Each one's so different.
Buttercup, the only thing she has is her beauty, honestly.
Peanut gallery over there.
No, seriously. Wesley, he's smart, he's dedicated, he's funny. Inigo is an inspiration.
Courageous.
Courageous. Fezzik is sweet, even though he's strong. he doesn't use his strength to his advantage or taking advantage of other people.
I actually see what you're getting at. Even the Sicilian, he is smart and he's determined. But Buttercup just...
she's just there.
I still like her a lot, though, because I feel like I can identify with her a little bit.
Katie, you're smarter than Buttercup.
Oh, thank you. In the end, she becomes the exact same person.
She doesn't really change. Like, other characters develop. Like, Fezzik, he decides that he can be smart. Because I think he was kind of just convinced that he couldn't be smart. And he was all brawn and no brains.
Mm-hmm.
And Inigo has finally completed his life school. And so he can now rest in peace and be happy. Wesley is finally with his true love. And he is so happy. Buttercup's just like, well, I always get what I want. There's nothing different. You're gonna have to go and get a copy at the library. Anyways, thank you so much for listening. We had a great time talking about this book. I hope you go out and I hope you read it.
And I hope you form your own opinions on characters such as Buttercup.
All right, so my name is Leanne. I'm going to talk today about The Boys in the Boat. The Boys in the Boat is a book written by Daniel James Brown. It was published on June 4th of 2013, and it is a nonfiction piece about the 9 Americans and their epic quest for gold at the 1936 Berlin Olympics. What's incredibly unique about this particular book is not that it's about a bunch of athletes, because there's lots of stories about athletes. It's not that it's another story about World War II or that it's another story about Olympic gold. What's unique about it is the story is really, truly about the boys that were in that 1936 Olympic crew boat. And it actually focuses on one boy in particular. His name is Joe Rance. And as he follows the life of Joe Rance from being a small child in rural middle America in the early 1920s, it follows his life all the way through to when he joins this crew team at Washington State University. And it's phenomenally well written. One of my favorite parts about how this book was written was that Mr. Brown brings in the history of the Great Depression and the factors that caused it, but he doesn't focus on the typical aspects that I was familiar with. They mentions the stock market crash and mentions the suicides, but what he focuses on is how it impacted those small rural communities all over the West Coast. And for Joe Rance, it impacted his family because his mother passed away and his older brother and he were then sent to different relatives while his father ran away to Canada for a year. And then when he came back from Canada, Joe had been recalled from the East Coast to the West Coast to live with his brother, and then his father took him back. They had a hard time finding places to live. It talks a lot about the difficulty of finding food. And even those who owned small farms in Washington, the state of Washington, and in the surrounding area, northern Idaho and northern Oregon, they really struggled to keep their farms going in the Depression, even to feed their own families. There's some really interesting, unique pieces, too, of how as Joe grows up, the author focuses on the building of the Grand Coulee Dam, because that's something that Joe actually worked on with his buddies, two of the guys that ended up on the crew team with him. And so to read that piece of history and what that camp looked like and how the president orchestrated those particular core projects across the United States, especially that particular one, and the amount of food they brought in and the shanty towns that were thrown up and the working girls. And throughout all of it, the focus is still on Joe's life. So you get these little pieces of history about the Great Depression and the impact, and then it always comes back to Joe's life. The other really neat thing, I am rather fascinated with World War II history and the lead up to the war as well as the aftermath of the war. And one of the things that is incredible is that he never lost sight of the anti-Jew movement, and he condemns it, but in a very clever way. He never outright says, you know, this is horrible and terrible. But the way that he portrays the people that were involved in building what he calls the Great Deception, you get the sense, you understand that he certainly does not approve, including he totally does not approve of the Americans who were pushing for not boycotting the 1936 Olympics. I learned so much about how Goebbels, who was the propaganda master of Hitler, and how he worked and he operated and how he controlled so much of what the rest of the world saw of Germany and how he pushed those laws through and manipulated it. And then Lena, whose last name eludes me, she was a German filmmaker. She was incredibly unique in that she was a woman who had started off as an actress who then became her own producer and director and became one of Hitler's favorites. And so she produced what most people are familiar with in terms of the Nazi film clips that we see of Hitler making speeches, of the stormtroopers walking, you know, in their parades. The Triumph of Will was her ultimate apex film, which she, towards the end of the war, tried to distance herself as much as possible. Didn't explain that piece, so I'm going to have to do some more reading. And again, as fascinating as those people are, he paints their portrait as people first, but there's always this underlying repulsiveness of like, here are these people that could have been regular people who could have done amazing things, but they chose instead to do this thing, which was bad. And I had no idea how Hollywood, they outdid Hollywood, and Hollywood at its best in terms of creating this great deception. They completely rebuilt, cleaned up, and cleaned out every city that all of the foreign athletes were a part of. There were only German loyal, Nazi loyal people in those towns. And the streets were perfectly clean and they were well received and everybody was friendly. And there was a lot of German spirit and a lot of Heil of Hitler, but it was like Disneyland. It was a giant theme park is what they were in, and none of them realized it because they had pulled it off so perfectly. But it always comes back to Joe Rantz. And so here we go. We're talking about World War II, and Joe Rantz was impacted by all of this because one of his teammates, as it turned out, had Jewish family in Europe, and he doesn't find out about that until just before the team goes to the 1936 Olympics. When I was reading the book, it had been recommended to me by a young fisherman named Luke, 21-year-old kid who knew he had such good taste in books. And he goes, what did you think of the crew races? So there's probably over a dozen different crew races that are described. And the most brilliant part about it is every single one is better than the one he tells about previous. And I don't know how he does it because it's a bunch of guys paddling about. I don't know how he does it, but it is. Every single race is more intense and more spectacular and more amazing than the one you read before. And you just can't stop reading. I would definitely recommend this book, especially to people who are not as fond of nonfiction because it's such a phenomenal story. It's not just the dry facts. It's truly the story of Joe Rantz and his life. The author actually interviewed him at the end of his life, which is how he got the story. And he starts the book that way. He starts the book by talking about how he walks into this home that was hand-built out of cedar by the man who is dying and how he interviews him. And it's very poignant in that it starts and it ends with Joe's passing away, because at the end of Joe's life, when he was talking to Daniel James Brown, there it is, he tells him, he says, you can't write about just me, you have to write about the boat. And the boat is this mystical idea, and it's this whole story where Joe was a part of it, but it was so much bigger than he was. So that's The Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown.
Hello and welcome to another in the series of book reviews from the resource materials of the Alaska Room of the Kodiak Public Library. Today's title is From Humboldt to Kodiak, 1886 to 1895 by Fred Roscoe, published by the Limestone Press, University of Alaska in 1992. My name is Bob Ross, and it is my pleasure to be with you today. This book is largely the first-hand accounts of Fred and his parents, Ida and Ernest Roscoe, in the late 19th century Kodiak. This family spent 6 years in the village of Kodiak from 1886 to 1891 and another 2 more years on Wood Island from 1893 to 1895. The Roscoes established the first American school at Kodiak and later surveyed and built the Baptist Mission and Orphanage on Wood Island. The Roscoes' child, Agnes Ernestine Roscoe, born the 3rd of May in 1887, is thought to be the first white child not of Russian descent to be born on Kodiak Island. The Roscoes were in Kodiak during the historic murder of Benjamin McIntyre by Peter Anderson. Ernest Roscoe was part of the searching party seeking to bring Mr. Anderson to justice. The account of this killing is the best, most detailed that I have read until the Kodiak Mirror article published earlier in 2015. This book gives a feel for the dynamics of the pre-1900 Kodiak, its social structure, the fur trade, the Russian church influence, social cultures and practices. My stated interest in researching and reading about Kodiak is roughly the World War II time period, 1939 to 1946. Yet this book was a valuable read even for one such as I with my narrow interest. So much information is contained in this book that is helpful in understanding the Kodiak people in its early territorial development, the town layout, and the Russian cultural legacy. This book helps me to better be able to assimilate other source information into better understanding and meaning. As an example, the statement that Kodiak was a sleepy fishing village until the 1939 construction boom. This book also is a jumping-off point for seeking further information in areas noted by Roscoe in his book. A large totem grave marker of high craftsmanship in the native cemetery on Wood Island is an example. The remains and location of Russian works on Wood Island, or how Prohibition worked in practice in Kodiak, are other examples of local history which might be further investigated. Law and order is another theme, with many examples from this book. For when the Roscoes first arrived, there was no local government, no federal control except for the customs collection, and for the oversight of the revenue cutters like the Bear, and murder was not an uncommon event. A Russian priest was murdered in the town of Yuzinki on Spruce Island. A man named Shu Shar Inkin was sentenced by the Kodiak town fathers on circumstantial evidence to 1 year confinement on an uninhabited island a short distance from St. Paul Harbor near Wood Island. It was that, or he was to be hanged. His sentence was self-directed. He could only row his skiff in for supplies and return to his Isle of Exile. If he was found in violation of his sentence, he would be immediately hanged. He served his sentence to the day, returning to Kodiak at great personal risk during a northwesterly storm, he not willing to wait even one extra day on his Isle of Confinement. He lived quietly in the Kodiak community thereafter. Did you know that Kodiak could lay claim to having the Brooklyn Bridge? Before the ash fall of 1912, there was a creek fed by at least two freshwater ponds, one in the area between Monk's Rock and the old craft store. The other pond is in the area of McDonald's on Lower Mill Bay Road. The footbridge was located near the creek's entrance to the harbor. The small suburb called Brooklyn was on the Pillar Mountain side of the stream, with the village of Kodiak on the other side. The bridge took its name from the Brooklyn suburb. Later, after the ash had filled the ponds and both drain pipes and fill closed over what remained of the stream, that Brooklyn suburb ceased to be. It was all just Kodiak then. Brooklyn Avenue got its name from this former suburb and roughly followed the course of the now-defunct stream after the drains were put in place. And it remained Brooklyn Avenue until sometime after urban renewal in 1964, following the tidal wave, to be now Lower Mill Bay Road. The crook that's in the main street of Old Kodiak is due to the village development and building before the ashfall and eruption in 1912. Fred Roscoe's account of the 1890 death of U.S. Customs Collector Finnegan mentions the Brooklyn Bridge. Finnegan's lifeless body was found submerged in the Near Island Channel just off the American Commercial Company's wharf, which is now the ferry dock and visitor center. Investigations showed a trail of blood from the dock all the way to the Brooklyn Bridge, where a pool of blood was found, as though whoever was carrying the body, or Finnegan himself, had rested. That blood trail continued across the bridge into a Brooklyn native woman's house, where evidence of a terrific fight was found. Everything was topsy-turvy and blood-spattered, including the walls. Finnegan had a reputation of being a mean, ugly man and picking fights when he was drunk. He was known to have been drinking the last time he was seen alive. Very few people liked him. The coroner's jury, after several days' investigation, ruled that Finnegan had met his death by falling off the wharf and hitting his head on a spike sticking out of a piling, thus cutting off the top of his scalp and drowning him. Much, much more is remembered in the pages of this autobiographical book. I really enjoyed From Humboldt to Kodiak, 1886 to 1895 by Fred Roscoe, and believe you will too. I hope you have enjoyed this book review from a selection of the books of the Alaska Room in the Kodiak Public Library. My name is Bob Ross, and until our next book review, I bid you good reading. Thank you for tuning in today.
Thank you, Bob. And thanks again to everybody who has given me book reviews for the Community Roar segment. We really appreciate you letting us know what you love to read so we can share it with the rest of the town. And thanks again to Stacey Studebaker for coming in and interviewing with Tayton on the Beyond the Cover segment. We really appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing you next month at the library with your Octopus in the Outhouse book reading. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. I'm Athenia, chair of the Kodiak Public Library Association and host of this show, and we will be back with you again next month with more talk for book lovers on Dog-Eared Reads on KODK 90.7. Thanks for listening.
Little beauty, heaven in your breath, the simplest of pleasures, the world at its best.